We're in chapter 2 of John Graves' book, From a Limestone Ledge, a collection of essays and anecdotes about life on a hardscrabble acres in Texas, the hardships and headaches, and the occasional rewards of rural living. Graves entitled this chapter, More Than Most Want to Know About Fences. As you might guess, it's a rumination about different types of fencing meant to keep domesticated critters in and wild critters out, insofar as that's possible. As for the old-world institution of hedges, the prickly, impenetrable linear thickets, beloved of birds and other small beings, that outline many fields in the British Isles and Normandy and thereabouts, it never really caught on this side of the ocean, maybe because in Eastern America in the old days there was a glut of wood for rails, and when settlers reached the prairies and plains where wood was scarce, they had a rough time finding any thorny plants well enough adapted there to form a hedgerow. Before barbed wire showed up to meet their need, they did try hard along those lines. Here and there in central and near West Texas, as well as the states to the north, you can find isolated broken lines of spined burdock trees which document that forlorn effort to cope with these new conditions, and I believe the sometimes lovely wild rose that's turned into an aggressive pest along our coast was brought in for the same reason. Some Mexicans have skill at training prickly pear and challa and other cacti into fences around a small piece of ground, but I haven't met any Anglos who can do it. Maybe again because it entails a lot of patience. Perhaps we can omit consideration here of such expensive oddments as city-style chain-link fence, or those ingenious brick-lined ha-ha ditches dug out in vanished centuries by very low-priced or chattel labor in Mother England and parts of our tidewater southeast. Robert E. Lee's birthplace at Stratford-on-the-Potomac has a good example, as I recall. Or flights of fancy like the fence someone had built a few years ago in my neighborhood out of upright pipes with oil well sucker rods welded across them. That one held up well, except where drunks had veered off the road and whacked it with their cars, and was handsome enough if you had a taste for aluminum-painted sucker rods. But sad to say, it wouldn't hold calves. Some good working corrals are built that way, but higher and stouter and with more closely spaced rods. And so we come down to wire, or war, bob war, as it's known throughout much of the state of Texas. Readers of Walter Prescott Webb's The Great Plains will recall that the barbed form of this commodity ranked right up there with the six-shooter and the windmill as an indispensable tool in the settlement of the plains. It did away with the open-range system of grazing and the way of life that went with it, in the process causing rough armed conflicts here and there, war wars, maybe a punster would call them. It allowed the introduction and proliferation of improved breeds of cattle, and along with a number of kinds of net wire, it's still as indispensable as ever it was on the plains and elsewhere too. Many people dislike barbed wire intensely. It's, of course, mean stuff designed specifically to inflict pain and thus to be repellent. And nobody who has ventured afield and had its prongs rip his breeches or his hide or both, let alone work bloodily with it building or patching fences, is likely to waste much soft affection on it. Furthermore, it has associations with violence and oppression, being linked quite correctly in the public mind with concentration camps and the ghastly trench warfare of World War I. Most country dwellers get past this revulsion because they have to, as a sewage plant worker has to get used to the smell. But some continue to resist, most notable among them, I believe, being the owners of high-strung horses, and these have a valid point. Nervous horses don't mix well with anything on which they can hurt themselves, because if they can, they usually will. We are much cursed in these cedar hills where I live with tangles of old rusty barbed wire that are remnants of ancient fences dating back, in some cases, to the last centuries. Sometimes they've been balled up into real chevaux de frise by bulldozers clearing brush, and sometimes they're just lying on the ground where they drop from rotted post waiting to snag your boot or pants cuff as you pass. Barbed wire collectors, a special breed, think these archaeological reminders are fine, but nobody else does that I know of. Even if for years you've made a practice of throwing any pieces you see into the back of the pickup for hauling to the dump, some will still be waiting around. When a cow blunders into such a tangle, she stops dead and carefully disengages whatever foot or feet have been grabbed and goes her placid way. But a horse, especially a good one, and especially with a rider on him, may well go into a frenzy, enmeshing all four legs before he's through and possibly severing some arteries and tendons. And he's capable also of tearing himself all to hell on a perfectly normal upstanding wire fence. There are some other objectors, too. I've noticed that the gentler sort of recent returners to the land, especially the younger ones, are wont sometimes to equate barbed wire with things like police brutality and military ways of thinking, a viewpoint that pops through occasionally in the publications they favor, such as the Mother Earth News and Countryside. Some are vegetarians of the purest sort, and like their elder patron saints, Scott and Helen Nearing of Maine, eschew any form of ownership or exploitation of fellow creatures, which, I guess, eliminates worry about fences, unless in terms of a neighbor's livestock. But more, probably, keep milk cows or goats and pigs and maybe some calm horses or donkeys for pleasure and work, and among these I seem to discern, as the movement advances in years and its adherents tend more and more to be tough survivors, a little less inclination to inveigh against J.F. Glidden's thorn and repellent invention. Trouble is, it works. The possible forms in which various kinds of wire can be combined to make a fence are myriad, and though to us country types the subject is fascinating enough to merit book-length treatment, I doubt the average reader would stand still for such a disquisition. The common form for cows, as practically everybody knows, is four or five evenly spaced barbed wires held up by wooden or steel posts to a height of 4 feet or more. Barbed wire can be made to serve for smaller stock as well, if you want to go to the trouble of putting up 8 or 9 strands and making frequent inspections for the rest of your life to locate spots where staples have popped out or wires have sagged, for hogs and goats in particular make a steady effort to find such places before you do and to get out, or in if in is where you don't want them. Hence the utility of net wire, which can be in pretty sad shape and still keep serving as a reasonable barrier to such inveterate questers. It comes in a confusing array of sizes and shapes which I have no desire to enumerate. As an example, though, probably the most common net in my part of the country, at least since our Angora goat era came and went with the decline of the mohair market, is what the dealers call 10, 35, 12, 14. Decoded, that means it has 10 horizontal line wires, is 35 inches high, has its vertical or stay wires spaced 12 inches apart, a requisite with horned goats, since the often-seen 6-inch spacing causes them to get their damned heads harpooned into such apertures, in which position they remain until defunct, or until found and arduously freed, and is composed of 14-gauge galvanized wire, 12 being better but more costly. It comes in 330-foot rolls, that's 20 rods, and is usually put up in combination with 3 close-spaced strands of barbed wire above it, to bring fence height to 4 feet and to keep larger stock from crowding down the net, as they will if given a chance since it has no prongs to prick them. And if hogs are around, yours or neighbors, you'll do well to stretch another barbed wire at ground level to keep them from rooting under. Such fencing, given ordinary maintenance, will hold most domestic beasts usually found in our part of the world, although if you run your mainly Brahman cattle, which are fine jumpers when hungry or panicked or randy, you probably ought to make it 5 feet high. And if, like some, you own exotic game animals or just want to keep your deer on the place and unwanted hunters out, you'll have to go up to 8 or 10. Not that some hunters of the more endearing sort won't climb over anything or cut a hole for entry. But in my experience, the worst enemies of net fences are horned bulls, a pair of which can utterly mangle a section of it when standing on opposite sides and bragging about how rugged they are. One stage of this game, after the early bad-mouthing is over, involves raking the head and horns back and forth across the stay wires, destroying them, and a frequent aftermath is that one bull suddenly finds himself where he has claimed he dearly wishes to be, on the other side with his foe, whereupon he may well flee in terror. Such displays of machismo are not usually visited on barbed wire for obvious reasons. Bulls aside, all wire is pretty strong stuff, but the effectiveness of that strength in a fence depends on how well you build the fence, for the best of wire is not much good if put up droopy and loose. It has to be stretched across the post and has to stay stretched afterwards so that the whole fence is a taut and elastic thing. The stretching is done with various tools and techniques whose description I will spare the reader, but it can only be done right if you have built adequate corner and end post assemblies to stand rock firm against the pull of the wires that are anchored to them and of the occasional beastly shoving. Among obsessed fence builders, who are many, this is a subject of intense concern, as shown by the numbers of enormous cedar trunks or sections of power line pole that you see serving as corners in the countryside, some of them set 4 or even 5 feet deep. For the less obsessed hole diggers among us, 3.5 feet is usually enough, and a collision with buried rock ledges on a hot day can make us settle for even less. Enough! All right, I won't go into the matter of different kinds of line posts and tamping and all that, or into water gaps that are needed where fences encounter streams, or wax lyrical about such items as the heavy gauge net made up especially for the King Ranch and available to plain mortals too if they want to pay the tab, or the fabulous Elwood V-mesh non-climbable wire, about as expensive per foot these days as stone, but incredibly stout and durable in its heavier form. I salvaged some of this from a farm where it had been put up in 1924 and used it to make corrals, which purpose it is now serving well after 50-odd years in the weather. I know one man who uses it to hold in a herd of buffalo, some sort of ultimate test, I should think, for fencing. Nor shall I deeply explore the subject of electric fences, a highly effective form that's cheap and easy to build, and instills enormous respect in creatures familiar with it for anything resembling a stretched wire. A bull, for instance, may touch it once a year with his nose when a heifer is in heat on the other side, but no more often than that. It is no good far from the house in rough country like ours here, for deer and such bang into it and cause shorts, and you have to do a lot of trudging to find and fix them. But nearby, it's quite handy, besides furnishing much innocent amusement for its owner and his guests when new animals unused to modern conveniences are making its acquaintance. I used to feel guilty about that amusement, until I figured out the reason I laughed was that I had been stung so often by the thing myself. As this essay may show a bit too fully, what working and worrying with fences over a period of time does to you is to turn you into a fence fanatic. A decade or so ago, a nephew of mine spent the summer of his 17th year building fences here on the place, laboring hard and well and often alone, for I had other work elsewhere. Some years later he told me with a certain note of aggrievement in his voice that the experience had soured his former unthinking enjoyment of pastoral landscapes. Riding along a highway, he would find his attention inexorably drawn to the fences that paralleled it, noting the size and strength of corner post assemblies, assessing the height of the goat net or the number of barbed wires used, and passing moral judgment on the unknown human beings who own them. For all of us fence fanatics know you can tell a lot about a man by looking at his fences. It passes, though. We grow a bit more charitable in such matters as other concerns and age begin to shape us in reluctance to spend whole days with pliers and stretchers in the maintenance of our own wire walls. Whether through mellowness, or something else with a harsher name, we develop a bit of doubt that a sag here and there really amounts to all that much, so long as our cattle usually stay at home and other people's usually stay out. And from that point, I suppose, it's but a few short philosophical steps to the outlook of those brothers with their shotguns, or would be if our front porches were only in the right place. Chapter 3 is entitled Building Fever. Nearly anyone with an eye for construction carries about in his head a catalog of architectural gems and oddments seen while driving through one countryside or another, and some of them, along his more usual routes, get to be old friends. He may even grow a bit possessive and secretive about them. They're his. In Texas alone, there are scores of structures that I begin to look for, often unconsciously, long before I come to them on trips. Barns that are polygonal, or notched into hillsides, or otherwise remarkable, courthouses, churches of special flavor, corrals built out of railroad ties or stone or interlaced billets of mesquite, unclassifiable flights of fancy of various kinds, and houses of all sizes and materials notable either for handsomeness or because in their aspect there's embodied somebody's idiosyncrasy so sharply assertive that each, for better or worse, is easily distinguishable from any other house the beholder's eye has ever beheld. Ranches or farms, all of whose buildings have a unifying personal imprint of this latter sort on them, are not uncommon, and sometimes whole small communities are marked. One of my own pet examples of this is a certain straggling tiny crossroads village in near West Texas. Call it Elm Tree. It's the sort of place that used to have its own church and school and Sir Stay Grow and maybe even a cotton gin, but now it's turned satellite to a county seat a dozen or so miles away, its population sparse and for the most part decrepit, half its scant houses empty beneath decaying roofing, its store and schoolhouse stuffed full of someone's baled hay, its handful of youngsters bust off daily for education elsewhere. It has the strong mark of one man upon it, a probably part-time and almost certainly deceased mason, who is to me simply the mad arch-builder of Elm Tree, for I have never wanted to stop and inquire about him, preferring to form my own vision of him through his work. At some point, this artisan discovered the Roman arch and fell in love with it. Most of the place's houses that were put up before the early 30s or so, and few from the look of things were put up much after that, show evidence of this obsession, some only in an arcaded porch or walkway, a few in windows and doors as well. As a medium, he preferred flag-laid limestone, the sort that's put up on edge and fitted jigsaw hunks rather than bedded flat, and polka-dotted that with darker stuff, lining some of his arches with red brick while making others of stone throughout. What appears to have been intended as his masterwork is an unfinished small square stone chapel in the village cemetery. Roofless, its thick concrete-cored flagstone walls petering out of the top in jagged lichened serrations, it boasts nonetheless as an entranceway a tall, noble, round-topped arch 8 feet wide, through which a passerby may glimpse the delicate green of the Johnson grass and scrub chitam wood that thrive in cracks of the slab floor within. Though Elm Tree is not directly on the road to anywhere I usually go, I make a jog to pass through it when I can. It isn't that I really like the mad arch-builder's work. In truth, I lack enthusiasm for walls of peanut-brittle flagwork and prefer thick lintels across the top of the masonry openings, and if I ever do try to construct any arches, they'll probably be of the segmental type, not Roman. But I like the fact of that work's existence, and I like the arch-builder himself as expressed in it. And when I idle past the little graveyard within whose sun-baked precincts he must lie, quite possibly felled by his labors on its shrine, I raise my hand in a salute that is not at all ironic, for we have a kinship, he and I. A lot of other people are kinsmen to him also, especially in the country. Like tetanus, the organism that causes construction fever thrives in rural air, and, like mumps, it seems to hit you hardest when you catch it in mature years. A good proportion of countrymen are infected with it early enough in life to build up some resistance to its efforts, But others, including many of us who elect as adults to make countrymen of ourselves, come down with cases as violent and lasting as that of the elm tree master. I know that many townsmen have the urge too, but often the scope within which they can yield to it is rather straitly defined. The need to make a 9-to-5 living in town terms doesn't help much, nor does neighbors' conservative disapproval of both the activity itself and the results when fancy has run a bit wild or execution falls short of intention. Bureaucracy through city building codes and such can raise fat obstacles, and on most town-sized lots, even space is a potent limitation, as is the general city belief that plumbing and carpentry and electrification and all that are best left to the professionals. In consequence, most urban would-be builders have to nurse their malady in private and to palliate its ravages with the fabrication of barbecue pits and tool sheds. If fortunate, sooner or later they get to build a house in the suburbs in the sense of having it built to their taste, and at that point they vent their frustration by hectoring thoroughly all architects and contractors and artisans and laborers in sight. Not that I would be construed as looking down my nose at people who have things built, as long as whatever it is that gets built has on it the stamp of their preferences and quirks. This essay is more or less about types like me, with a need to put things together themselves, but I doubt there is one of us who fails to feel, as the years accumulate and vigor doesn't, some envy of that elder world which endured until a couple of generations ago, when anyone with a little wherewithal and imagination could wave his hands at cheap, skilled workmen and make his fancies come true, whether or not he ever got calluses on his own palms. Out of that system came Monticello and many another noble country home, and all those fine follies on British estates, at which doltish sightseers snicker without seeing the lasting statement of self that they are. In contrast to the cities, out here beyond the exurban fringe, neighbors often live a half mile away or more behind shielding hills and trees, and for the most part want nothing better than to mind their own business while you mind yours. Bureaucratic pickings are too thin to tempt much regulation down upon us, and the services of professionals are scarce and costly enough that we've learned to get along without them most of the time, and indeed have grown quite brashly confident in our manual skills, laying stone on stone with aplomb and affixing board to board with arrogant hammer blows. In us susceptibles, something about the very possession of acreage demands its adornment with structures that certify our presence and will keep on certifying our past presence in time to come. I don't pretend that this is very admirable in philosophical or ecological terms, since it is an extension of the same impulse that has smeared man's mess all over the face of nature throughout the world. But it is a human fact. Once your brain has latched on to the idea that if you had the energy and time, or the money, to hire enough workers and machines, you could start building the Tower of Babel all over again on that knoll above your vegetable garden, and nobody on this earth could say you nay, you have undergone a change. Even if you hold to the belief that construction ought to fit into a landscape rather than stand out stark on it, as an incipient builder you have, to some degree, set yourself against wildness and natural disarray. The tower, now that we've mentioned one, may be the utmost symbol of this, the man-made finger against the sky that means, in part perhaps, toward destiny and disorder and death, what an upthrust finger does mean. I suspect that most of us have a personal tower embedded somewhere in our imaginings, although few of us ever find it standing somewhere or get around to building it for ourselves. I myself have not yet quite given up on the notion of a stout limestone affair, 20 or 30 feet high, on the rise behind our house, its lower portion to serve as storage for 10 or 15,000 gallons of water, but on its top a breeze-haunted study from which its exhausted builder might gaze out vacantly at far horizons. Our time is gone now for this episode of The Bookshelf here on Spokane Public Radio. We're reading John Graves' delightful tales of rural living, a book he called From a Limestone Ledge, published by the University of Texas Press. I'm Tom Bacon. The Bookshelf is a production of Spokane Public Radio, Vern Windham, executive producer. Be sure and join us next time for a continuation of John Graves' description of the Mad Arch Builder of Elm Tree.